Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are few people who have understood more clearly, who have articulated more eloquently, and been, I think, in general, more effective in warning about communist China and the Chinese Communist Party that misrules it than our guest for this full hour, I'm very pleased to say. His name is Dr. Stephen Mosier. He has been a social scientist who has actually lived in and studied closely China. He has written extensively on the subject, including most recently an extraordinarily important book, Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order. He is articulate, as I say, passionate, but most especially deeply knowledgeable about the challenges of our time, and has, among other important contributions, been the founder and president of an extraordinarily important organization, the Population Research Institute. Steve Mosier, it is wonderful to have you with us. I am so grateful to you for what you've done over the years since 1979, when you first encountered the hard truth about China. And I'd like to just say, first, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, and to invite you to talk a little bit about your insights into the nature of the regime from that momentous year forward, and notably as we commemorate the 30th anniversary of Tiananmen, which took place a decade later.
Well, thanks for having me on the show again, Frank. This is a very important topic. China, of course, wants to dominate the world, and it wants to destroy the United States in the process, reducing us to a provider of raw materials and agricultural products for the Chinese industrial machine. So this is the confrontation of the 21st century. After the communists came to power in 1979, they began carrying out mass killings, purges. In 1949, they began carrying out political purges, killing tens of millions of people. The Cultural Revolution followed, a famine that killed 45 million people. After that, the disastrous one-child policy with its 400 million forced abortions and cases of infanticide. China is ruled by the largest killing machine the planet has ever seen. You know, the normal Communist Party comes to power and kills about 10% of the population that it controls over time, calling them counter-revolutionaries and so forth. China, the Chinese Communist Party, has done far better, or far worse, we should say, than that. They've killed off about 20% of the Chinese population over time. Things came to a head in 1989 when we saw millions of people take to the streets of the capital city of China, Beijing. In fact, it was not just in Tiananmen Square where the demonstrations were being held. They were being held in Shanghai. They were being held down south in Guangzhou, in the interior, in Chengdu, and other places. So this was a massive popular uprising by young people, middle-aged people, elderly, who had had enough of 40 years of misrule by the party and were demanding elections. They were carrying placards with quotes from Jefferson and Lincoln and Washington. They were demanding an end to bureaucratization, an end to corruption, and a more open society. And we all know how their demands were met. Their demands were met by troops and tanks who were brought in to put down the uprising. And those troops and tanks were ordered to kill. We know that. We know that Deng Xiaoping, who was in charge, who came out of retirement in 1989 to take charge and overrule the decision of the then party general secretary, Jiang Zemin, to sit down and talk with the dissidents. He said, Deng Xiaoping said, nope, we're not going to talk. This is a threat to the continued rule of the party, and it must be put down by force. Do not be afraid to shed blood. Well, the local army, Frank, in Beijing refused to fire on the students. And so they had to bring in an army from the border region of Mongolia, which was largely conscripts from that minority, who had no connections in the capital, had no feeling for the people there, and were told that there was a violent uprising, which is false, and were ordered to shoot down unarmed students in the central square of China's capital city. Probably 10,000 people died. The Chinese Communist Party denies it, but that's the report we got from the British ambassador at the time. 10,000 people killed in the capital city. Other deaths occurred in Shanghai and Guangzhou and Chengdu as those demonstrations were put down there.
You know, Steve, we had a program of our Committee on the Present Danger of China the other day, and Cheng Guangcheng, a very courageous, prominent dissident, said that in addition to 10,000 being murdered in Tiananmen Square, there were perhaps another 28,000 who were wounded in the course of that attack on these unarmed and innocent peaceful demonstrators. This is a staggering example of what you were describing earlier as the ruthlessness and, the murderousness of the Chinese Communist Party. Steve, we have to pause, but when we come back, I want to just talk you through what that has meant in terms of the kind of control that the Chinese government exercises over its people. I'm fond of saying that any government that treats its own people this badly can't have very kind intentions towards ours. So this is about us too, folks. Steve Mosier is our guest. We'll be right back with much more right after this.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Dr. Stephen Mosier is in the house virtually. We're talking with him about a subject on which he is one of the country's foremost experts, Communist China and the Chinese Communist Party that is the, malevolent ruling instrument of China and the force that is turning its people into a very grave threat to us. Steve is, among other things, the president of the Population Research Institute. And his books include The Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order. Stephen, we were talking a bit about Tiananmen and about Chen Guangcheng and his insights about the wounded there as well as those murdered. Pick up that story, if you would.
Well, what happened after the massacre in which tens of thousands of people were wounded? They were, of course, taken to the hospitals. They were put on life support in some cases, on IVs. The next day, the very next day, Frank, army trucks pulled up in front of all the hospitals and clinics in Beijing where the wounded had been taken and dragged the wounded away, loaded them onto trucks, killing some of them in the process, and took them to an undisclosed location. None of the wounded ever reappeared. What do we call that? We call that killing the witnesses. The Communist Party was determined to eliminate all the witnesses to the massacre. So it not only killed people in the square, it killed the wounded after the initial attack. Yeah. This is the level of cruelty that we're talking
about.
But
this conforms. This is not an anomaly. This conforms to what you said about the brutality of the Chinese characteristics, if you will, to the communist practice of mass murder of their own population. 20%, I think you said, is what's believed to have been their toll. And that's just to this point. This continues, of course. But Stephen Mosher, one of the things that, you've done such really important work on is addressing the kinds of techniques that the Chinese have used, not just to murder the living citizens, but those that have not yet been born. Talk a bit about the population control apparatus and the role that it plays in China's Communist Party's ability to maintain this kind of absolute tyrannical control over its people.
Back in 1953, the then chairman of the Chinese Communist Party, the greatest mass murderer in human history, I call him Mao Zedong, declared that it was the proper role of the Chinese Communist Party not just to control production, but to control reproduction. In other words, the party was going to say not just how many cars and trucks and planes would be produced each year, but how many babies would be reproduced. They got into reproductive control in a big way in 1979 and 80 when I was in China, when they ordered women who were in some cases 5, 7, 9 months pregnant to get abortions because the party thought in its wisdom that there were too many children being born. 400 million abortions later, 2 years ago, they decided there were too few babies being born. And so after forcing hundreds of millions of women to get abortions, after killing millions of babies at birth, actually in some cases after birth, now they're telling everyone in China they should have two children. Communist Party members have been told they must lead by example and have two children. And I'm very much afraid, Frank, that we are seeing the beginning of forced pregnancy in China, where the government will order everyone to have two children, on the understanding that it's the party, not individuals, who should be controlling all the reproductive systems in the country. That's what we're headed towards.
Talk a little bit about the mechanism. One of our colleagues, Reggie Littlejohn, has been doing work on this too, and has called them the womb police. How does this process of assuring that either there's no child in a womb or there is a child in a womb, if that's the new diktat, how is that enforced, Steve Mosher?
It's hard for Americans to imagine how intrusive government controls in China are. But if you're if you were, say, a young woman working in a factory, there would be on the wall of the workshop that you work in your name, and above it would be listed the months of the year. And during the time the one-child policy was enforced, you were required to put a check mark by your name every time you had your monthly cycle. And if you didn't put a check mark by your name, you would be subject to a pelvic examination to see if you had become pregnant. So your personal hormonal cycle was on display for the whole world to see. Now, it is still true in China that no single woman is allowed to bear a child. So any woman who gets pregnant while unmarried is automatically subject to an abortion. That rule stays in place. But again, we're moving towards forced pregnancy, and that's going to unleash a whole different set of abuses. But again, it's all of a piece. It's being created. It's being controlled by a government that thinks it has an absolute right over not just your body, but your mind as well.
One of the things that I wanted to just visit with you about, Stephen Mosher, is how in the current period, the Chinese Communist Party has, well, shall we say, morphed this general idea of totalitarianism into a kind of super Orwellian Big Brother surveillance state. Walk us through this evolution, if you would, and the kinds of instrumentalities that are now being brought to bear by the government of China for the purpose of, situational awareness, is I guess what the military says, about everybody in the country.
Well, China has always had a very formidable police state, and people have been required to eavesdrop on and report on others. But this police state has been recently upgraded using machine learning, using face recognition technology, using artificial intelligence, and all that has been woven together into a kind of, I don't know, call it a fearsome cyborg of state control. The Chinese Communist Party now runs the world's first high-tech digital dictatorship. And what that means in practice is that if you jaywalk across the street in Beijing, the video surveillance camera will record your violation. The face recognition technology will identify you, and you will automatically be fined and have money deducted from your bank account. That's kind of an innocuous example of the kind of thing that's happening. If you are in China and you associate with the wrong people, or if you say critical things about the government, or if you post anything online that suggests that Xi Jinping is not the exalted God Emperor of the Chinese people, you will lose points on your social credit score. And guess what happens if your social credit score gets too low? Well, the first thing is, when people call you, they hear a siren and a warning saying, do not deal with this person. He is a danger. The second thing that happens is you can't buy a plane ticket. You can't buy a high-speed train ticket. You can't rent a hotel room. Your children can't enroll in school. The list of punishments goes on and on. And the worst thing that happens, if you are judged to be too critical of the government, if your social credit score goes too low, guess what? You can be preemptively arrested and sent to re-education for a period of time, not because you've committed a crime, but because the government thinks that you are on the verge of or susceptible to committing a crime against the state, and you need to be brainwashed in advance of that event. So this is the level of 24/7 surveillance that has been a kind of dystopian nightmare for freedom-loving people for decades, and now it's being realized in real time in China.
Yeah, on steroids, as they say. And this brings me to another point. We'll talk more about it in our concluding two segments with you, Steve Mosher. But the trouble, it seems, is not simply that the Chinese government is perfecting techniques for domination of its people. And by that, I mean not just, you know, the Han Chinese, but the ethnic and religious minorities too, you know, Christians and Uyghurs and Tibetans and Falun Gong and so on, most especially. But that they are now in the business, it seems, of exporting this surveillance state technology to authoritarians or would-be authoritarians elsewhere as an adjunct to or sort of the logical follow-on to their digital Belt and Road Initiative build-out. Could you say a word or two about what the implications are for the wider world that China is now making this kind of technology available to it as well?
Well, yeah, think about the fact that China, the Chinese Communist Party, is not content just to incarcerate its own population in a virtual prison. I mean, that's what it is, right? A virtual prison where you're under 24/7 surveillance by the state, and anytime you step out of line, there are consequences. China, of course, is marketing this to its partners around the world. Guess who the first buyer of China's digital dictatorship has been? The dictator of Venezuela, Maduro, was China's first customer. And I'm sure he won't be the last, because China's busy hawking its creation to like-minded socialist dictatorships. I wouldn't be surprised if countries like Russia and Iran were also interested in buying this technology because of the extraordinary control it gives you over your population. You can punish people without the need for a human intervention. The face recognition technology, the machine learning, the artificial intelligence does it for you. It keeps everyone under surveillance all the time. It's a frightening prospect. It is, 1984 come alive in a way that George Orwell could not have imagined.
Yeah. Steve, we have to pause for just a moment. Much more with the author of The Bully of Asia, Stephen Mosher, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're visiting with Dr. Stephen Mosier, one of our country's preeminent authorities on China, a country he has lived in and studied closely since 1979. He has mostly been out of the country, though, which is good news for us because he's been able to speak truthfully about what he learned there in the year or so he studied it on the ground. A revelation, I think it's fair to say. He's a social scientist by training, an author, notably, of most recently, Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order. Steve Mosier, again, thank you so much for giving so generously of your time today. I did want to talk with you about the Bully of Asia and what in particular. We've talked in the previous segments about the character of the regime, its ruthlessness towards its own people, its willingness to extend that, social credit score, surveillance state system elsewhere. But that's only a piece of what the Chinese, of course, are up to at the moment, notably under the form of this so-called Belt and Road Initiative. Would you talk a little bit about what that bespeaks of this so-called China dream of Xi Jinping and what it might mean for the rest of us?
Well, I think what it means for not just the United States, but the rest of the world is the world is going to have to make a choice. And they can continue to live in a world that is dominated by the United States in a peaceful, beneficial way, a world which is prosperous and largely free and respects human rights, or they can live in a China-dominated world, which would be, I think, very much the opposite of that. It is really a stark choice between freedom and tyranny. Who knew after the fall of the Soviet Union that we would be in the same situation 30 years later? But we are. And in fact, the Chinese realized this, the Chinese Communist Party realized this a long time before we did, because it wasn't long after the fall of the Soviet Union that Deng Xiaoping, the leader of China in 1991, said to the senior Chinese Communist Party leadership, there's a new Cold War between the United States and China will win this one. The Belt and Road Initiative, linking together all of Eurasia linking it to the Chinese industrial machine and making it dependent upon China for cheap Chinese-made goods and making the rest of the world a supplier of raw materials for China's factories. That's the old dream of dominating Eurasia, of dominating the heartland. The idea of Harold Mackinder from a century ago that he who dominates the heartland will dominate the world. And if it's true that China were one day to come to dominate everything from East Asia all the way to Europe, then the rest of the world would look like appendages. Africa, Latin America, North America would be single continents trying to stand against this this dominant power. So that's
or
the Belt One Road. That's
simply be vassal states if the Chinese Communist Party has its way, would it not?
Absolutely, because the Chinese Communist Party doesn't really think of the world as consisting of equal nations. It thinks of the world as consisting of China's friends and China's enemies. And China's friends are basically vassal states, those which do the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party. China really doesn't have neighbors except, the adjacent countries have to bow in China's direction if they want to stay on good terms with that government. So this is really a stark choice that we find ourselves in, that the world finds itself in. And it's great that we now have, since the November 2016, we have a president and a government that understands the threat that China poses to the rest of the world and is standing up against it.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I believe surpassing concern is whether the United States government does, under President Donald Trump, now have a very different view of China than did its predecessors. That certainly seems to be the case. And yet, we also hear about, well, if we just get a trade deal, all will be well. We'll have this wonderful relationship with Xi Jinping, and it will enable us to fix some of the problems that have dogged American economic policy and security. How do you see the Trump administration's attitude towards what Communist China is up to?
Well, I think there are a number of people in the Trump administration, Frank, who understand that no deal with China may be the best deal of all. And the reason I say that is China under Xi Jinping, and in fact, before Xi Jinping, going all the way back to Mao Zedong, has the idea that the Chinese Communist Party should be the single all-dominant power, not only in the world, but in China, and sees civil society, sees the rule of law, sees property rights, the free market, sees all of these things as a long-term threat to its continued rule. And they've, in fact, said that. I mean, there is a directive that was published not long after Xi Jinping took power back in 2013, Directive Number 9 of 2013, which we have a copy of, which lays out the threats to the Chinese Communist Party's continued rule. And it goes in great detail about why it is impossible for China to adopt the rule of law, why it is impossible for China to allow civil society to grow and flourish, including freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, labor unions, and so forth. It lays out in great detail that all of these things are threats to the continued rule of the Chinese Communist Party. Now, these are the kinds of things that we're requesting China to do. I mean, we want China to protect intellectual property rights. Well, that requires the rule of law. We want them to abide by global standards. That requires them agreeing to abide by the decisions of international tribunals, which they commonly ignore. So the Chinese Communist Party, I think, internally has consciously rejected any compromise in these areas because it would weaken their authority. They don't want judges making decisions. They want party leaders to make decisions, and they always will. That's why I think ultimately a compromise with the United States that solves these fundamental issues is impossible because it will be seen by the party in China as tantamount to giving up power. So I don't think we're going to reach a long-term deal with China. And I think more and more nations are going to have to decide whether their long-term interests lie in expanding their relations with America or with China. And I think most of the world is going to side with the United States. If the United States stays strong, if we signal weakness, maybe they will shift sides. But the U.S. right now, with high employment levels, with rising wages, the stock market doing well, the real estate market doing well, we're the envy of the world. China's going very much in the opposite direction.
And I take it that you feel, Stephen Mosher, from what you've said and the inference to be drawn from it, that we should not, as some, like my friend Gordon Chang has said, signal weakness effectively by once again propping up the Chinese Communist Party, which is going in the wrong direction, as you say, but wrong direction for them, maybe right direction for us in terms of its difficulties. But doing a trade deal with them isn't likely to bear fruit, certainly over the long term, and will have the kind of effect that previous deals have had, which is to legitimate and to enrich and enable the Chinese Communist Party to continue to exercise control at home and spread its efforts at dominating the rest of the world globally.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got to stop the transfer of power, a transfer of money, transfer of intellectual property to China that has propped up this this communist regime for decades. Remember, this is a Communist Party that has a state-owned sector that is losing trillions of dollars each year. There's no question about it. The China rails, for example, is $750 billion in debt. All these high-speed rail trains that look so great in China, none of them are making money. The only sector of the economy in China that makes money is the export sector because we've allowed it to profit off the U.S. consumer market for decades. If we begin to disengage supply chains from China, and with the tariffs, factories closing in China, moving into Taiwan, Vietnam, India, even back to the United States, we are going to fatally weaken the Chinese economy and send such a shock through the system that once again, the Chinese people may begin gathering in Tiananmen Square and demanding fundamental change. That's, I think, in our best interest. I think it's in the best interest of the Chinese people for that to happen, for us to stay strong.
Yeah, which brings us back, though, to what we were talking about earlier, Stephen Mosher, and that is the prospect that the surveillance state apparatus will essentially preclude the Chinese people from ever again being able to exhibit that kind of opposition to the regime, massing or even planning to mass in protest would be intercepted early on with very draconian punishments meted out to those who might be contemplating such a thing. How do you get around that in a scenario that might see sort of this wellspring of demand for change akin to what we witnessed 30 years ago at Tiananmen?
Well, I think it would be a very different breakdown than what we saw at Tiananmen, which was truly a mass movement. But in this case, we have a machine, the political machine in China is beginning to devour its own. We have hundreds of thousands of communist bureaucrats, party members, military officers in prison now charged with corruption. Their real crime, of course, is not corruption, but they weren't. Their real crime is that they weren't part of Xi Jinping, president for life, Xi Jinping's faction. And there have been demonstrations by retired military men protesting some of these charges, these trials of military officers, which supposedly we believe were backed by serving military members. So there are fractures within China.
We have to pause for one last break.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the final installment of this important conversation with Dr. Stephen Mosher about communist China and specifically the threat that it poses to us. Steve Mosher is a social scientist by training, a very accomplished author, notably, most recently, of The Bully of Asia. He is the founder and president of the Population Research Institute, and you can also see some of his handiwork with us at the Committee on the Present Danger, China, which he is a member, I'm very pleased to say. Steve Mosher, we were talking in the last segment about what China aspires to do around the world, techniques it's using, like this Belt and Road Initiative to expand its reach, accompanied by the sort of digital infrastructure of the social credit score, surveillance state, 5G wireless technology, and the like. And yet you offer us some hope that despite all of this, at home and abroad, there may be opportunities to do what President Reagan did in the 1980s to take down the last totalitarian communist regime, namely that of the Soviet Union, that sought our destruction. I'd like to hear a bit more about the kinds of policy approaches you believe the United States government can and must take at this moment to accomplish that.
Well, I'm a great admirer of President Ronald Reagan. I had the privilege of writing a number of speeches for him after he left office. And it, in effect, his policy towards the Soviet Union is not all that dissimilar to the policy that we should, and in fact, in many cases, are adopting towards China right now. We have a military buildup. Reagan engaged in one. We have one under Trump. We have the denial of technology to China. China is much more astute at stealing it, of course, than the clunky Soviet blundering spies were. But still, we're trying to put the kibosh on that. And of course, finally, we're strengthening our economy while weakening our adversary's economy in different ways. And by putting tariffs on trade, I think we're sending China's economy into a meltdown. China right now is desperately spending hundreds of billions of dollars of its rapidly shrinking stock of U.S. dollars to stimulate the economy. And yet it's having very little stimulus effect. China has a national debt 300% of its annual GDP. Ours is about 100%. That's worrisome enough. Theirs is three times that and growing rapidly. Consumer confidence in China is way down. There's a debt money and millions of people who are desperate to get out of China, get their assets and get their family out of China. The Communist Party is losing its legitimacy because it's failing to deliver on economic prosperity. You know, after Tiananmen, they said, we may kill you. You may not like us. You may hate us, but we're going to make you rich. Well, if they can't keep the rich part of that promise, what's left of their popular support disappears. And then there's the international pressure. The world is falling out of love with China. You know, it's not just President Trump who's hammering China. Australia has banned Huawei, China's telecom maker that works with the government to spy on us. The European Union will probably follow Australia and the United States in banning Huawei and other telecom providers. Japan, I think, has realized it has to choose between working with us and working with China. They've definitely chosen us. So even smaller nations in China's backyard that you thought we would think would be on China's side, Malaysia's backed out of its billion-dollar development deal in the One Belt, One Road. Vietnam wants to draw closer to us as well. And we're putting an energy squeeze on China. The sanctions on Venezuela and Iranian oil put a squeeze on China's energy supply. China is nowhere near close to being energy independent. We are. And I think the short-term and long-term goal of the Trump administration is to put enormous and continuous pressure on China to force them back on their heels. Now, will that result in a revolution in China? Not a popular revolution, because as we know, the Communist Party will gun down people in the streets to stay in power. But their own elite, the military elite, the political elite, the Communist Party elite that has benefited from the policies of China's corruption and intellectual property theft and so forth over the decades will grow dissatisfied with the leadership. And there will be internal factions, I think, that can begin fighting against one another. And when that happens, who knows what the outcome will be.
Yeah. Let me ask you about a problem that I've been mulling for some time, and that is that in your appreciation of the nature of totalitarian systems, and specifically the Chinese Communist Party, is really why I want to talk to you about this, Stephen Mosher. The sort of fallback for a lot of these kinds of regimes over time has been that if all else fails, try to conjure up some sort of external threat to the country, appeal to nationalism and patriotism, and mobilize the public behind even austerity measures that can be justified because you have to contend with that foreign adversary, which would presumably be us. When you combine that with the sort of cumulative effects of something we discussed earlier in the program, Steve, and that is the effects of the one-child policy having given rise to, well, tens of millions, I've heard as many as 40 million young men for whom, military age young men, that is, for whom there are no women. Does that not give rise to a sort of social dynamic that might tie in with the party's need to have external adventures or war, to put a fine point on it, to help relieve their internal pressures and maintain the party in control?
Yeah, I don't think we can take these kinds of geopolitical aspects lightly, because, you know, back in 1941, we blocked access to Japan's need for oil, and the attack on Pearl Harbor followed. So we're putting China in a similar corner, I think, as these policies are continued. And I think we have to be prepared for an adventure on the Korean Peninsula, or even more likely, some attack on Taiwan, or perhaps an incident created by the Chinese in the South China Sea, in part as distraction, in part to give the U.S. a bloody nose and perhaps get us to relax our policy. we should be signaling very strongly to China, and I hope we are, that that any such action would be met with an equal and opposite and perhaps more dynamic reaction. But yeah, that's certainly a possibility that's occurred to me. China is busy, of course, trying to win friends around the world. And people talk about a new Sino-Soviet alliance. This time it would be a Sino-Russian alliance. But I think that is limited in scope because Russia itself is an object of Chinese envy. Russia is sitting on, you know, hundreds of thousands of square miles of territory that China regards as its sovereign territory that was stolen from us by unequal treaties. Russia, Far East, much of Siberia, China believes belongs to it. So I think Putin needs to be very, very careful in how closely he aligns himself with the Russian bear with the Chinese dragon.
Yeah, I was thinking of that as you were talking earlier, Steve, about the neighbors of China being more or less vassal states or states that the Chinese have in mind translating into that condition. The Russians seem well on their way with the Chinese having occupied much of Siberia, as I understand it, and seemingly having their sights set on much of the rest of the place. This is, of course, part of a very interesting dynamic that makes the study and the national security practice of our time so fascinating. And Stephen Mosher, you are bringing great acumen to bear on it, and I so appreciate your visiting with us from time to time, and I hope you'll do so again in the very near future. We're anxious to learn from you the sorts of things that I think decades of serious study of the Chinese Communist Party and what it has done internally and what it has in mind for the rest of us, as I say, is absolutely indispensable. So I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.